360's The Week That Was for BTC Constructions.
It is Friday morning. It is time for The Week That Was. And joining us in the studio this morning, the opposition leader, Leah Finocchiaro. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone.
We've got Kate Warden, the member for
Sanderson.
Good morning. I've forgotten everyone's electorates. 2 weeks after the election, I've forgotten everything.
You've got election brain.
That's right. And Matt Cunningham from Sky News.
Yes,
good morning.
My party fared about as well as Territory Alliance at the election, Wolfie. So I don't have a seat, but I've got a seat here. So
the Matt Cunningham party, eh? Wonder if it would have disrupted things in the way that that some would say Territory Alliance did, Matt. Who knows? Anyway, speaking of the election, well, the election results, we know that the recount for seats with the margins of 100 or less votes will be counted or completed. That's been completed now, and recounts for the seats of Araluen, Arnhem, Barkley, Blaine, Daly, Namajira, they were all undertaken yesterday. And then, as I understand it today, it will be the final counting of those postal votes. It's all still looking pretty tight in about four of those seats, certainly in Araluen, Barkley and Blaine and Namajira there. Well, Namajira is incredibly tight still, isn't it?
It is all very tight, and of course our candidates are waiting nervously for those results today, and we're certainly hoping that the postal votes come in and are in our favour. But regardless of that, our entire team did an exceptional job fighting for jobs, fighting for, you know, a stronger economy and for law and order to be front and centre, and we go forward holding our head proud that we achieve what we have achieved, and we'll hold this government to account.
Kate, some of them are incredibly close. Like when you look at Araluen, for example, Robin Lamley, 2,160 votes, Damien Ryan, 2,143. You go down to Barkley, Sid Vashist on 1,691, Steve Edgington, 1,671. The one that is really has been surprising, I guess, and we did speak about this last week, is the fact that Blaine, well, Terry Mills didn't even get a look in, didn't even reach 1,000 primary votes, but Mark Turner and Matthew Curl are fighting it out there. 2,084 votes to Mark Turner, Matthew Curl, 2,069, and the one that is still really very close, and there's sort of been some discussion today that maybe Territory Alliance could somehow fit into this seat in some way with Matt Patterson. Bill Yan at the moment is just out in front on 1,770. Cherilee Taylor, 1,764. Six votes separating them.
So, Katie, I think the bulletin comes out daily from anybody that subscribes to the NTEC website. They give you these bulletins daily. And I noticed yesterday, and I saw in the paper today, there is an article about they're going to do the full distribution recount again, I think, on some of those really tight seats. And we could see, some of the analysts are saying that we could see a change. But, I mean, we're the same. We've got candidates that have really worked right way through really hard, and we're trying to support them now because this is obviously, you know, not a good time. It's almost 2 weeks that they've waited, and it's so tight that I think we'll know some sort of result by tonight, which will be good for the waiting to be over for those people that are really just on a knife edge. Obviously, we're looking forward to working a few of them into our caucus.
I think the thing that we need to learn from this election is that, like, we're lucky in a way that Labor's guaranteed 13 seats, because if they weren't, this past fortnight would have been an absolute farce, right? We're 2 weeks on almost from the election, and there's four seats where we don't know the result. Yep. And I think the past 2 weeks have highlighted some things that really need to be addressed with how elections are run. One is the declaration votes. I think this declaration voting system, I got a real issue with it, where someone can rock up to the polling booth on election day.
Yep.
They're not on the roll, but they can vote. If someone they know says, yeah, that's Katie Wolfe, you know, she lives there, then they can vote.
No, I think you need a passport or something. You need some identification.
And then it gets checked later. Like, surely should be a situation where the roll closes on this date. If you're not on the roll, you're not on the roll, because I think that's open to manipulation by political parties. And the other thing is the postal vote process. The fact that for 2 weeks after the election, you know, we're still waiting for postal votes, and it appears, correct me if I'm wrong on this one, Kate, that it's kind of an honesty system. You've got to say, oh, yeah, I voted before 6 p.m. on the 22nd of August, but I sent it in afterwards.
Yep.
That doesn't pass the pub test for me.
I think on that note, I'd agree. I think it does highlight the need for some possible legislative change. I think that's obviously something that, that could happen. I think particularly with COVID, I don't know about any of you, but I've certainly tried to send some mail. It highlights an issue around the mail with COVID. I think that possibly for this election, some votes are going to be received that have been delayed by COVID. I know that I sent a parcel overseas, and some of these people are voting from overseas, and it sat on the Brisbane tarmac. I could see it clearly on the Australia Post app for 3 weeks, and I thought I'd sent it well in advance for my granddaughter's birthday, and it actually missed her birthday by about 4 days. I was really disappointed because, you know, you pay the extra as well to get those things there.
Well, and this is the thing, you know, in these COVID times, we know that things like the postage is obviously being delayed, but and then when when you're taking into account in some of these seats, you're literally talking about six votes that could separate the winner from the loser. Mm. I mean, it is unbelievable. You'd be absolutely spewing if you missed out by six votes.
And when there's so much at stake, I don't think, I'm not saying people are dishonest, but I don't think an honesty system is acceptable to decide an election.
I think that's the system that's always been, though. But on the overall election too, I would make and it's more of a personal observation about the inconsistencies. Leah might have some comment about this as a candidate, that, you know, you saw Berrima where you could park, walk in, vote in the I'm talking about pre-poll here. You could go to Casuarina. It was all very orderly, but thousands of, well, not hundreds of A-frames everywhere. I don't know about anybody else, but that drove me crazy, and I think that that's a council jurisdiction and that should have been tidied up right from the start. And then you go into the city and it's like the old gauntlet. Mm. Yeah. For me, that was inconsistent. And then come election day, you're put behind, and I understand this is a COVID thing, but you put some booths had no availability for candidates. So the Moyle booth, I think I had 200 votes at the Moyle booth, but couldn't have anybody there giving out how to votes. But at the same time, because that serviced Wagamama for me, but at the same time at Sanderson, we were all stuck behind a corral away from where people walked in, so people had to opt to come and see you. But it was the whole look and feel of it. People came in and joked at us like, oh, yeah, you're behind the wire. And it was really, I found...
It was strange.
It was strange. But can I just say, Kate, your government 3 years ago are the ones who changed the law to allow this to happen. Like, the designated areas are ridiculous. It's, you know, and now we're again talking about going back into the parliament to fix what you guys made worse.
The 100-metre rule wasn't ours, actually.
The 100-metre rule
was not ours. That was Adam Giles that made that change.
That's right, but the designated area is yours. The extension of postal votes is yours. A lot of these things were changes that you made. So
I guess the thing is, though, because the election's sort of, it's always 4 years, you know, it's obviously 4 years apart. So sometimes what can happen, I know myself, when you have, you know, when you organise an event of any kind, you know, once it's finished, you sort of think, oh, thank goodness that is over, and you move on. And then it's not until the next 4 years that you go, oh, hang on a second, maybe we should change a few things here.
That's what I'm highlighting, Katie. It was the inconsistency of, if it's going to be applied, then if we're saying about designated areas, then that should have been at every booth. If we're saying that Casuarina was the standard, then that should have been the same in the city. I'm saying
the inconsistency
for me as a candidate was... Yeah. You know, how do you staff something like that? How do you get volunteers at one and not at others?
Well, look, I guess, you know, I guess it is, I think that there needs to be a bit of a look at this afterwards. I think the other interesting thing that we've had a few listeners raise with us over the last week or so is the preferencing and you know, even the fact when you go on those primary votes, if you just sort of went on primary votes, obviously sometimes the outcome would be quite different
We would have won at least 16 seats straight up.
We've always had a preferential voting system, and we have a preferential voting system, and I don't think a first-past-the-post voting system, you know, is going to fly. But as to the actual rules, like, it's a bit like the AFL. They keep changing the rules and making them worse. I think, you know, let's just go back to what was happening before you know, the Giles government first changed the rules, and let's just go back to how it was, and, you know, that seemed to work pretty well for everyone. That designated area is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
Howard Springs on polling day.
Yeah.
And the four candidates were like locked away behind this rope to the side, trying to wave at people as they were coming in to vote.
Maddie, we were instructed on the day we couldn't even talk to people. We couldn't wave at people. We had
to
stand
there. But we knew that when we were doing the legislation.
Yeah, but interpretation.
Yeah, it's not interpretation. It's in the law.
It's a dumb law.
You've obviously you've got a situation where you're not able to, you know, to talk to people or interact with them on voting day. But in the lead up, you know, if you go and vote early down at Darwin City, from Territory Alliance yelling out to me, "Don't forget Territory Alliance." I was thinking, mate, that makes me not want to vote for a party if they're yelling out to me that I need to do something.
It's inconsistency, Katie, and I think that people, you know, in the city, if you went to pre-poll in the city, your experience was extremely different to Berrima and Casuarina, and something needs to change about that, and that's interpretation, and that's the inconsistency I think we need to look at.
All right, so obviously there will be a bit of a look into the way in which that all happens and the way in which the election results, you know, the way that the election is had. But I guess the discussion now turns to, well, realistically, how government is going to be made up, i.e. portfolios and who is going to be ministers, but also for the opposition. Leah, obviously, you're going to have to be looking at who's going to take those shadow portfolios. I might go to you first. How are you thinking that you're going to do this? I mean, presumably, you would have been thinking, and obviously, some of these seats are still too close to call, but you would have been thinking the likes of Damien Ryan and even Steve Edgington might have been coming into, you know, into your team and could have been taking on a shadow portfolio.
And they still could be, you know, and we hopefully will find out today what the results will be. But we're obviously waiting to see who the full team is. We've certainly got six seats with an opportunity to get up to 10 today. So we'll see how that goes. And certainly we're hopeful that everyone gets over the line. And then once that's done, of course, government have not created their cabinet yet. So those ministries will, I don't know if government are making new ministries, are splitting departments up, all of those types of things. And then we'll announce our shadow cabinet.
Well, and obviously Dale Wakefield and Jerry McCarthy will no longer be in that cabinet, Kate. Surely they're going to call you in?
Oh, it's not that straightforward, Katie. I think we get elected, and I mean this very, very seriously, we get elected as local members. And anything beyond that is, you know, obviously it's great if that's what happens, but ours is definitely a decision of caucus, and we cannot meet until we know what our caucus makeup is. So we're obviously hoping that we'll have Tiny and Blaine. We're really hoping that Cheryl Lee gets over the line in Barclay. And, you know, that's just the way we're looking at that. It's
But you extended your lead in that seat, didn't you? I mean, like, surely based on your performance as a backbencher, and also based on the fact that you managed to extend that lead in what a lot of people would have thought was going to maybe be a tighter race, surely those couple of factors would actually come into play here and you know, and
I listened to some of the commentary here on the week before, and, you know, you guys weren't sure that I was going to get over the line. I'm holding to your account on that. I would question
but we're not choosing
your viability.
The cabinet.
But, look, I think on the, you know, even on the day, it's very hard. People, I think, over time are very private about their vote, and I like that because it is a secret ballot, you know, for how they vote. Even on the day, I didn't think I was going to get that margin. Maybe that's a bit about myself and the way I view it, but as I said, you get voted in as a local member, and I've spent 4 years being a local member. I'm hoping that my increased margin is a reflection of that. Katie, I absolutely love the work, and I love being out in the community all the time, and I think that maybe showed in the result that I've got. Being in cabinet is a completely different step altogether, and that is decided in accordance with our rules around caucus.
If it's decided by
caucus, why has the Chief Minister already come out and said that six people are already guaranteed a position in the cabinet?
Well, what he said is we've lost two cabinet meeting members, and so at the moment there's two vacancies. But that's up to the whole of the caucus to determine next week.
Well, he's already made it clear in several press conferences. He's made a what would appear to be unilateral decision that those people who were already in the cabinet before the election will remain in the cabinet. So it's not a caucus decision, is it?
It is a caucus decision. And so we don't know what the caucus is made up of yet. I understand what you're saying, Matt.
But if it is a caucus decision, then he can't really come out and say that.
His view at the moment.
It's his decision.
And he said that is he's lost two cabinet ministers, so there's two vacancies. What happens in caucus next week, we'll wait and see. That's, you know, that's
I'm
as
interested
much as
to
we know.
See if people like Nicole Manison stay on as treasurer, because she has been the worst performing treasurer we have ever had in the territory. We've got an $8.2 billion debt. The chief minister has got no plan to get us out of it, no plan for the future. So I think Territorians are expecting a serious shake-up of that cabinet if they are serious about growing our economy and tackling crime.
Kate, your background is in housing.
Oh, I came from housing originally,
Yep, you came from housing. Is that a portfolio that you'd like?
I haven't thought about any of those things, Katie. You're going to keep putting me on the spot here.
That's nonsense. She hasn't thought about
it. I knew that you were going to go here today, Katie. And, you know, I willingly agreed to come and sit here, and that's fine. But as I said, I got elected to represent the people of Sandys in Parliament. I think people obviously think I'm doing a really good job at that, and that's what you get elected for, and caucus will meet. And once we know the final lineup, I'm actually really looking forward to seeing who we've got in that caucus. Caucuses are hugely robust. As Leah would know, it's difficult if you don't have a great number of people, but obviously she's increased her number this time of people that will be with her. I'm equally going to look forward to seeing who Leah puts in as her shadow portfolio. Now she's lost her potential treasurer.
How do you decide? How do you decide it? Do you just go one by one through the different cabinet positions and say, all right, we're going to vote now on the treasurer, and who wants to be treasurer, and you sort of nominate?
No, I think you'll find that portfolios are allocated.
I don't have my hands down by my sides.
So portfolios are allocated post an election of a ministry.
Oh, so you actually go, these are the... So how do you decide it then? You go, these are the... Who says these are the
your
nine people?
Your cabinet, and then they get portfolios.
Right. So how do you do it? You don't do it one by one. You do it
as
a
big block. I'm not going to give away every secret that there is, Matt.
No, it's not a secret. Is it in the rules? Like, it must be in the Labor Party constitution or something? Is it that you?
No.
It's not.
No.
How you elect the cabinet is not in the Labor Party's rules.
It's a decision of caucus. Caucus will meet.
No, and just do it however they want.
All caucus decisions are completely confidential, and we will go into caucus and we will meet and we will make those decisions about who's in cabinet. And then those people that are elected to cabinet will get portfolios allocated to them.
But if it's done as a block, like, who decides who the people are going to be? Like, does the chief minister say
yourself?
No, well, I am confused because I'm confused.
So
does the chief minister say
you might need to get elected, Matt? If you'd have been elected as a Labor member, you might know the answer to these questions. And you know, we
I don't know if they'd have him,
Katie. You know, no, we wouldn't have him. We put together his parliamentary platform. Remember, we put together his policy platform in this very room a few weeks ago. He didn't run on it. You're outside the tent, Matt. You're outside the tent.
All right, we better take a short break. You are listening to Mix 104.9's 360. It is the week that was.
360's the week that was for BTC Constructions.
It is just 25 minutes after 9 o'clock. It is Friday morning. In the studio with us, Leah Finocchiaro, Kate Warden and Matt Cunningham. Now, we kicked the week off this week with, I had Anthony Albanese on the show, and he declared that it is beyond his comprehension that the Morrison government would introduce a sweeping power to veto state and territory agreements with foreign governments and not look at the sale of the Port of Darwin to a Chinese company. This discussion sort of continues to come up. I know it was interesting, well, it's always an interesting one, earlier this week when we spoke to Anthony Albanese about this. He seems to be on a little bit of a different page to what the chief is, because the chief minister has said that, you know, we're not going to be giving the port back to Lambridge, or back, sorry, we're not going to be getting the port back from Lambridge at this point in time. I did ask Albo, you know, who would pay for it, and he said that really the federal government would have to look at footing the bill, which I thought would be interesting. I don't know that they'd be prepared to do that.
Well, you know, if they'd stumped up the $50 million they'd been asked for before the port was leased to Lambridge, you know, they'd be $450 million in front on that deal, wouldn't they? I mean, that's what gets forgetting here, is that, you know, there were several Northern Territory governments who went to the federal government and said, we need investment in this port, and they weren't willing to give it.
Yeah.
And so it's a bit rich now when every federal politician, when they're looking for a free kick, and there are some from both sides, Anthony Albanese and your friend, the senator, who, what's her name? Concetta Fiavanti-Wells.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Theravanti.
There we go. You know, every...
The Italian would know how
good
to
Italian name.
They go for the free kick. Oh, you know, let's talk about the Darwin Port again. I'm so sick of that story. It's just like the deal's done. Lambridge has leased the port. Mm. And let's be honest, the port's in better shape now, 5 years on from the Lambridge lease, than it was 5 years ago.
The thing that I think's interesting, though, or an interesting element of this discussion, is that, you know, if it were to happen, you'd have to say that Lambridge would be incredibly annoyed and incredibly angry. And that China would be as well. But in addition to that, you know, obviously we're talking about the same company that is then building the Western Hotel down at the waterfront. I did get confirmation. And I did get confirmation earlier in the week when I interviewed the CEO of the Department of Business, Sean Drabsch, and he did say that they've got to start that construction by early next year or the government takes that land back.
Katie, I think we have given them a 12-month extension. The reasons they've asked for that is COVID has delayed a number of things for them and made it really, really difficult for them. But back on the port, you know, the real concerns federally, I think, are around government to government, whereas this is, you know, this is a commercial arrangement. The territory still holds 20% in that, and I think there are an awful lot better things and ways. If the federal government wants to give us some money, let's give us some money and we'll stump up something that's going to create a lot more jobs locally.
I mean, the thing that always sort of gets my attention, though, on this discussion is that we hear all the time how strategically important Darwin is. You know, like we're talking about the only deep water port then, you know, in this part of Australia. I would have to double check on, you know, the proximity to others, but you're talking about how strategically important we are. I can understand why it keeps being raised as a political issue, because you're right, Matt, it is a bit of a free kick because there's a lot of people that still feel a little bit worried about it.
I think it's cheap politics, to be honest, and for a federal politician to, you know, it's just scaremongering and misinformation. You know, this is a commercial arrangement that has meant there has been tens of millions of dollars poured into the port, into its infrastructure. You know, it's a done deal. And if we start to question commercial arrangements, then we put at risk a number of industries and a number of investments. Mm. So I think what the federal government's doing is right. And like Kate said, it's about government to government. And, you know, we've got local councils right around the country, hundreds of them making their own arrangements with other nations. And so
we've got 11, I think, Darwin. City Council's got 11 of those agreements.
You know, so it's about pulling together some consistency and making sure we're all working in the national interest. I think everyone understands that. But for, you know, a federal Labor leader to come up here and just start throwing around the port for political capital is, you know, just pick somewhere else.
And it annoys me that it's always the Darwin port. There are other pieces of infrastructure in this country that China's invested in. Yeah. But it's like, well, because there was the controversy around the Darwin port at the time, it's the one that they always pick out for the free kick. I mean, the Victorian port, the Chinese have a stake in the Victorian port now. The Northern Gas Pipeline is part Chinese owned, you know, but they always pick out the Darwin port as the sort of, you know, big, ooh, scary. I mean, if things were to escalate from a security point of view, you know, the provisions are there for us to take the port back, you know, like there's not, it's not a situation where...
You know, there'd be a lot of people listening this morning, though, who would be thinking, well, there might be the provisions there, but let's be honest, you know, China hasn't necessarily in the last sort of couple of months shown that they're willing to be overly agreeable.
Yeah, but if they're going to, you know, if a big Chinese warship's going to sail in there, I reckon we're probably going to see
We'll know about it.
Oh, bloody hope so.
Yeah. Well, at least you'd oppose it right from the start, Katie. Yeah. And I think that that anger, there's still a fair bit of anger about that decision. But I think you need now to keep moving forward and do the best thing for Territorians. And that sort of expenditure here could create jobs rather than buy back an asset that, you know, longer term, as Matt said, they've done some massive improvements down there. They've showing that they want to invest in the long term of the territory. And it's not a government-to-government arrangement. This is a commercial enterprise. I think it's important that we keep some perspective around
it. Let's talk about the Western Hotel development. And we know that there is now quite a significant delay. We had that confirmed, obviously, by Western as well, or by Lambridge, I should say, throughout the week. It has been revealed this morning, the ABC News had revealed that almost $5 million in taxpayers' money has been spent on that Lambridge project, on top of $1.5 million, I believe, on legal and IT fees, as well as money being invested to market the hotel or to market that development. It is an eyesore. down there? Like, are we in a situation now where realistically, if it's going to be delayed for 12 months, should we just take down the fencing and just try to make it look a little bit nicer so that, you know, the people that live at the waterfront and those of us that frequent the area don't have to really see what looks pretty terrible in a beautiful spot of the world? I know it's not an area that is overly beautifully developed at this point in time, but should we just get rid of that, you know, the big fencing that goes around and try to make it a bit more accessible again?
Well, I mean, that'll come down to a matter of safety and a number of other things, I imagine. What's most disappointing is that we've got an example of the government fumbling its way through major projects again and not being able to deliver this one for Territorians. Of course, this was a project started under the, you know, two governments ago now, and we're into the fifth year now of the Gunner government, and I've been asking questions about this in Parliament, you know, over and over again, trying to get information about what is going on with the hotel, what is government doing, how much taxpayers' money has been spent, and this government has just been, you know, shirking the, you know, hiding away from those questions, giving me absolute garbage responses, and so this is really disappointing. It's another economic blow to the Territory, and I certainly hope over the next 12 months it can be turned around.
I think, you know, the Landbridge Group have been quite honest, and I think there's been some speculation around in the media around the difficulties they've had contractually to start with that delayed the project, and they have now been very clear that COVID is making it very, very difficult for them to proceed.
Yeah.
But I'm with you, Katie. I think that we, obviously, the Waterfront Corporation would have a say in that, as would government around the site. So you're talking about the site. If there is to be 12 months, look, I personally would be happy to wait for 12 months if that project's going to go ahead. We have been really clear, if it doesn't go ahead, we will take the land back, and we will proceed with something else on that site. It's really an important strategic site, so it's important that we keep that in perspective, and everything's on slow at the moment.
Yeah.
So it's not like we can suddenly say, oh, you know, if you want to start pushing this now and say you've got to build.
Well, the thing is,
I
don't want to burst everyone's bubble, but really, are we really expecting someone to build a hotel at this point in time when we can't have tourists come to the Northern Territory? Like, I sort of think it seems like a no-brainer to me that they're not going to go ahead with it. It doesn't make common sense.
Predominantly, probably targeted at the higher end as well. I mean, we have tourists everywhere, Katie. I don't know if you've been stepping out, but I'm certainly having a
55,000 people have still crossed the border.
Caravan parks are full, and there's people everywhere.
Lots of domestic tourists, but I think the aim with the six-star hotel is to get high-end Chinese tourists. And right now, our international borders are closed, and our flights to China are suspended. So
I think 12 months is quite reasonable to wait for that project.
This is also a lesson to the government about timing. They are very happy to drag their heels and talk about things well into the future. But of course, you know, decisions that are made by corporate entities is all about timing, and had this had been facilitated properly, it would already be out of the ground by now, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. So we would have seen the benefit of the construction phase. You know, it would already be there as an asset that had done its job by putting money into our economy. And so this government needs to change its approach with major projects and facilitate and fast track much faster than what it has been in the past.
Well, this discussion does sort of lead us into a couple of other discussions, and one of those is the fact that we learned earlier in the week that Australia is officially in its first recession for almost three decades, with the June quarter GDP numbers showing that the economy went backwards by 7%. It is the worst fall on record and slightly worse than most economists had predicted. Household expenditure fell by 12.1%. I don't think that's any real surprise, given the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty for people in terms of their jobs and that type of thing. I can certainly understand why people have and maybe not spending as much money as what they usually would on different bits and pieces. I guess we've all known that this was coming. I don't know if anybody's overly surprised by the fact that that we are in a recession. I believe, you know, realistically, most countries are in a similar situation at this point in time. But I suppose the difficulty in the Territory is that we've been going through a fairly tough patch for a while now.
That's right. We've effectively been in recession for a couple of years already. So, you know, COVID has just hit us really hard at our weakest time. And that's why action is so important. This government needs to get runs on the board with streamlining processes, streamlining approvals, cutting red tape, facilitating investment, doing whatever it can to make the Territory a great place to invest, because, you know, we need it more than ever now. And the competition for those people who are investing is very, very high. And so this government cannot wait. It cannot delay, it cannot sit on its hands, it must move swiftly and do things differently.
Katie, I think that, you know, people sitting out there would, you know, if they reflected over what the government has done and the measures they've taken over during COVID, with all the stimulus packages, you know, we've got some more coming out yesterday, the immediate work grants for those organisations that missed out last time. I know that I've got three in my, just in my patch that are just excited for that work to go ahead. That keeps people in jobs. And I think the economic modelling a few weeks ago was that we saved at least 7,000 jobs. Government is taking the hit. It's better than people foreclosing. Closing, you know, you every night, I don't know about you, but you turn on the television and you see the news and you watch the news, but it runs into those, you know, those current affairs programs, all those other ones, and they're highlighting what's happening with families interstate. And yeah, we have got people here that are doing it really tough, but some of the stories, you know, we're getting to a point now, I think maybe things will even get worse with the foreclosure of, you know, people are going to lose their rent, that rent holiday stuff's gone, banks are starting to want to reel in, you know, investment, that we're going to see some real pain coming. But we have got all of those stimulus projects. I know, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people have got taken the money out of their own pockets to do the home improvement scheme. There's a range of programs.
Kate, you're talking about stimulus, which is important, but it cannot last forever because your government has got no money. In fact, you have $8.2 billion less money than you should have. And that is a serious problem, because if you're not going to grow our economy and you are only going to provide stimulus, and again, the stimulus is important.
Your presumption that we're not going to grow the economy, well, you haven't so far.
You've actually put our economy into decline. So talking about stimulus is fine, but the money is gone. You have no plans. You took no plans to the election on the economy. And this is people's lives and livelihoods we're talking about. So it's fine to hark on about the tradie scheme and a bunch of other stuff, which was important, but it doesn't last forever. It's all running out. And where are you getting to? We've not had the worst performing economy in the nation.
Wolfie, was any plan to do anything about the $8.2 billion in debt? There was not one party that had a single policy.
That's not true.
Because, you know, gas will be a very, very big impact on our economy.
Well, you didn't talk about gas during the election, that's for sure.
Well, actually, I've talked about gas on here.
Because the election's over.
I'm going to take you on a bit of a different track, because I know that The Australian is reporting that a cabinet-level task force is going to offer financial incentives, including possible tax lures, for foreign-based advanced manufacturers and high-value businesses of more than $250 million to relocate to Australia as part of the budget's economic recovery blueprint. So the Morrison government is going to be targeting, they're going to be revealing today, they'll target mining and technology, food and agritech, agriculture, medtech, biotech and pharmaceuticals as part of its yet-to-be-released manufacturing package designed to shape Australia's post-pandemic jobs and industry agenda. Now, I think this is an interesting part of this discussion, because we've spoken quite a bit about becoming a manufacturing hub. I mean, Andrew Liveris, who is obviously heading up the task force, does want that to happen. I'd be really fascinated to see if we are able here in the Northern Territory to lure some of those companies here.
So what underpins that, Katie, is cheap power. It's that simple. And it's not about having gas as a long-term prospect, because you can look at renewables, you can look into the hydrogen strategy, which we have one. You need all of those things to come. But for the next 10 to 20 years, gas is going to be the solution here. It's going to be a big part of the solution, and that does... Cheaper power attracts manufacturers. We know that. Andrew Liveris has talked about that for many years, in fact. We're not going to step away from that. That is our plan. You can say we don't have a plan.
This goes back to timing. If the moratorium wasn't put in place, we would already be nearly at extraction phase. No, because this is the hard truth that you need to swallow.
We said we would have the moratorium, Leah, and we said we would do that work, and we've done it.
Now the federal government are looking to create manufacturing here in the territory. You said said the single biggest thing we need for manufacturing is cheap gas. Where's that gas coming from, Kate? Where is it?
The Beetaloo.
Okay. In how many years' time will that be ready to go?
Well, I'm not the mining minister, okay, but you might have
well,
to
it's
ask
probably
him.
About 3 years away. So if the federal government are ready now to create manufacturing,
crystal ball time.
We are not going to be able to take advantage of that because our gas industry is not ready for it.
Well,
so congratulations. Well done. Timing of the essence.
Your party has a really bad record in mining. It has a terrible record, leaving scars across the
rubbish,
Northern Territory
honestly.
In terms of rehabilitation. People don't
go
trust
back to Sanderson, Kate. You don't know what you're talking about.
What I want to hear is realistically, how are we going to lure some of these major
exactly.
companies to do business here in the Territory? Kate, good on you for saying yes, that the answer is going to be gas for
short,
the next 10
yeah,
years.
Short to midterm.
Short to midterm, but they keep talking about the Beetaloo Basin as having sort of the potential to supply domestic energy markets for 500
yeah.
years.
Yeah, I was going to say. Right,
that's not short term.
It's a very long time.
Are you only planning to frack the Beetaloo for 10 years or 20 years?
Well, those are commercial decisions, Matty, as you'd know.
Well,
they're commercial decisions.
Well, if they're, commercial decisions.
I think the mistake, can we say his name here? Terry made was actually preempting that industry would make that decision. So let me be really clear. Industry will decide whether they go fracking in the Beetaloo. That's what they will do.
Do we have a real opportunity here, though? And this is what I think, what I'm keen to get to, is do we have a real opportunity to, to capitalise on what the Prime Minister is set to announce today? We've been talking about becoming a manufacturing hub. How do we beat places like Western Australia? How do we sort of make sure that we're able to get some of these projects happening in the Territory
COVID-free, which is number one. How attractive would that be that you could come to the Northern Territory and
not if your investment
here?
Framework isn't right. So it's about our approvals, it's about our what incentives we can deliver, it's about having the right infrastructure, it's about having the right facilities. So it's really important that we get cracking. For example, Middle Arm, that is the intended heavy industry precinct. So we need gas pipelines to there. We've got rail, we've got road, but the headworks all need to be done. We need to be ensuring that we are ready to receive this type of investment and that our approvals processes are there and that they know they're going to be facilitated for those investments. If we don't have that, they will go somewhere easier.
And that's going to require leadership to stand up to what is a very loud but I think smaller than they have projected themselves as being, opposition to the gas industry, for instance. I'm looking over your shoulder, Wolfie, at the primary votes in Nightcliffe. The Labor Party, 2,336. The CLP, 830. So they're the two parties that were pro-fracking that ran in that election in the greenest seat in the Northern Territory.
Yep.
And that is more than 3,160 votes between them. Below that, the Greens and Territory Alliance, who have about 1,140 votes between them. So, what does that tell you if we were told that, fracking was going to be one of the biggest issues at the 2020
Absolutely.
Northern Territory election?
And I think that what's occurred, Matt, is that, yes, people are worried, but they also have this hat on that they want to see the Territory prosper.
Yep.
And, the process that we've been through to give people an assurance that we can be done safely here in the Northern Territory has been a really important one. We said what we would do. Politically, people want you to say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and then go through with it. We had a pact at the last, in the 2016 election, that we would put the moratorium in and we would investigate how that industry could progress if it could be done safely. We did all of that. That's a commitment we made to Territorians. We went through with that. And I think that is essentially that whole trust around doing it right. It was so, so important. So now, just reading out those votes, people have said, yep, you've got it right, let's go. And I think that's the mandate now.
It's
we
the
have
what's
that
next.
Mandate to do that.
It's
we
the
are,
what's next
we,
now.
We are going to have to take a very short break. You are listening to Mix 104.9's 360. It is the week that was.
360's the week that was for BTC Constructions.
It's 10 minutes away from 10 o'clock, and joining me in the studio for the week that was this morning, Leah Finocchiaro, Kate Warden and Matt Cunningham. Now, I want to talk about, the Prime Minister is today expected to push for a nationally agreed definition of a hotspot. And we know that the Tourism Minister, Simon Birmingham, had earlier this week said disproportionate approaches to state borders were costing jobs across the country. I know that there is still quite a bit of concern here in the Northern Territory from a lot of people. Even yesterday I caught up with the Mutijulu Corporation CEO, and they had identified, the fact that in Mutijulu they were still really quite concerned that there was going to be a plane scheduled to arrive today from Brisbane. Brisbane that was on one of those elevated hotspot alerts. I think I don't know exactly how you make sure that there is a uniformed approach, but there does seem to be some real inconsistencies around Australia in terms of what some states are happy to have happen and what others aren't so happy about. You hate to see these things become political, but I guess they do.
Well, I think the National Cabinet is meeting today to work through a number of those things. I do think that from what I've been hearing, that the Territory's held up as a really good example of what the Prime Minister actually wants to see consistently done across Australia. I know that I've got people coming into my electorate who want to see loved ones in Western Australia, but actually can't get in. We've had workers caught in Western Australia doing fly in, fly out. They'd like to be able to come home in their break, but they're being told that when they then go back to the work site in Western Australia, they have to be in quarantine for 2 weeks. It's making it very difficult, I understand that, but I do think the Territory is being held up as a very good example. And I agree with you, Katie, I've always just relied on, definitely not Facebook, but the alerts coming out of Secure NT. I think our messaging from the beginning has been Secure NT is that central font of information. I know I check it from time to time, and I subscribe to the alerts on that and I get those. So maybe, there have been a little bit of inconsistency with this one.
Well, look, there was yesterday when we caught up with Mutajulu, with the CEO there. Now, they'd said to us that they had seen on the website that the area of elevated alert in Brisbane had been taken off that website. Maddie Hepworth and I had looked into that, and indeed it had been taken off the website. But there'd been no pressure release or anything go out. And so then we'd contacted the Department of Health a couple of times and also contacted the Department of Chief Mins to try and make sure that we had the correct, the correct information to ensure that all of our listeners had that correct information. But it was also really highlighted when we spoke to the CEO of Mutajulu that in those communities, they need that really clear, concise information as well. And I think that possibly what happened, and I'm not trying to sort of, have a real crack at anyone here, but I think what potentially happened is in the lead up to the election, coronavirus definitely became a political issue. There's no doubt about that. The Chief Minister was making announcements on his Facebook page, which again, I understand it. He's the Chief Minister. He's got every right to do that. But at the end of the day, what we've got to make sure is that whether you live in a community, whether you live in an urban town centre, no matter where you live, that information has to be consistent and it's got to be coming out in a consistent manner.
From the same place.
From the same place. And that's really what it comes down to, I think.
And that's what we're not seeing. We've got the Chief Minister standing there in Parliament House with the royal flags behind him and giving some announcements, and then other times he's on his Facebook giving announcements through Facebook, assuming that Territorians are expected to check his Facebook for pandemic information, and then other times no information has come out at all. For example, when the 1.5 metre rule was changed for outside, I was at an event 2 days ago and someone said to me, oh, we're meant to be 1.5 metres apart, we're outside. I said, oh, don't forget the government changed that a few months ago. That's not the rule anymore. And again, that just came in and there was no information about it. I think very clearly we should only be getting health advice from the health experts. It should be a consistent way in which that information is always delivered. Take the politicians out of it, and then Territorians could have greater trust in what the information is and how it's being disseminated.
I think, Katie, everybody listens to your show. I think that today, just that message around the...
Just send the press release to us. You've got to make sure everyone's got it. Look, because I think for us in the media, we can get the shits and sort of say, oh, we don't know what's going on. But, fundamentally, it's not about me knowing what's going on. It's about the whole community knowing what's going on.
Secure NT is such a really good site. And I urge people to, yes, we'd love you to keep in touch with the Chief Minister's Facebook. But I would really, really encourage everybody to go to Secure NT and keep that as your font of truth.
I think the thing to have in the back of everyone's minds as well is that there's a lot of senior people living
Absolutely.
In our community that do not go on Facebook and they do not go and check the Chief Minister's Facebook page or the Secure NT website, and that's where places like the radio and places like the news become incredibly important for people being able to get their info.
Not so senior people who'd avoid Facebook too if we could, but unfortunately that's the way it's been set up.
If you were still running your political party, you would love it.
No, Matt, I would have a non-Facebook campaign.
Non social media. Yeah. All right,
Party, two votes.
We're going to take a very short break. Who's you are listening one? To Mix 104.9's 360.
360's The Week That Was for BTC Constructions.
Well, it is just a couple of minutes away from 10 o'clock. The time flies when you're having fun. In the studio with us this morning, Leah Finocchiaro, the opposition leader. Thank you, Leah.
Thank you.
And Kate Warden, of course, the member for Sanderson. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Katie. And can I just plug that it's wear your footy colours? I don't usually
wear. Oh, you do
my
have your footy colours on?
I've got my cat's shirt on, but it's the... And it's all for a good cause for kids with cancer. So if people want to go out and have a donation, make a donation today, it's the day to do it.
Well, I'll do you a deal, Kate, since my cats are playing your Tigers. My Tigers are playing your cats next Friday night. That whoever's team loses can donate $50 to the said cause.
I already donated this morning, but absolutely I'll do it again. So look forward to a smashing.
Matt Cunningham from Sky News, thank you for your time this morning.
No worries, Wolfie. Don't forget, run with Dad on Sunday.
Yeah, we'll be there.
What's the occasion on Sunday?
Well, it's obviously for Father's Day, for prostate cancer and men's health, which is obviously very important to me and to all of us. I think it's really also so important for us to celebrate all the dads and all the wonderful men in the community as well on Sunday. All of you doing a wonderful job. Matt Cunningham, what are you up to for Father's Day?
Sleeping in, I hope.
Good on you, mate.
Are you
good
not running with us?
Oh, I'm helping you out, Katie.
I'm helping you out.
Can you walk?
Kate Warden's helping and Leah's taking part. I love it.
It's great. Okay.
Good on you all. We'll catch you again next week. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Wolfie.
Thank you.
You are, of course, listening to Mix 104.9's 360.
360's The Week That Was for BTC Constructions.